Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Matt Wood, director of FedSoc Films. In 1996, the internet was forever changed by the passage of a little-known section of an unpopular and mostly overturned law, the Communications Decency Act. But Section 230 was not overturned, and in fact, some people argue it has become an integral part of the web's development as a dominant force in our modern lives. However, there are many critics of Section 230 and its effects on the internet, freedom of speech, and big tech. Many lawmakers, policy wonks, and pundits are calling for Section 230's repeal, or at least significant changes. On the other side of the debate are the voices defending Section 230's importance in preserving a free and open internet. This debate was the impetus for FedSoc Films' short documentary, Leave a Decent Comment, featuring experts on both sides of this important issue. One of those featured experts was Representative Chris Cox, who served in the House representing California from 1989 to 2005. And notably was the co-author of Section 230. We invited Representative Cox onto the FedSoc Films podcast to provide more insights into this topic, including places he thinks the film could have done a better job of explaining Section 230, and we'll also discuss his thoughts on the First Amendment's implications for Section 230, something we really didn't get into much in the short film. So this should be a fascinating discussion. Welcome to the show, Representative Cox. It's great to have you on.
Well, thanks, Matt. It was enjoyable being part of the film, and it'll be fun to discuss it.
Well, excellent. I appreciate more of your time. So to kick this thing off, I'd like to ask you, as the co-author of Section 230, if you can tell the story of how Section 230 came to be, and feel free to set the stage for those in our audience who may not remember a time before the internet, or at least not a time before Section 230.
Sure. 25 years ago, I suppose for some people a long time ago in terms of their own experience, and for others of us it seems like it was only yesterday, but the internet was still a thing. It was a real part of our lives even a quarter century ago, but of course the scale was different than it is now. So what we knew 25 years ago at the signing ceremony for what, as you described, was a larger piece of legislation, and not just the Communications Decency Act, which we were mated with. Section 230 was originally called something entirely differently, the Internet Freedom and Family Empowerment Act, and it was stuck together after passage with the Communications Decency Act, which Ron Wyden, who was my co-sponsor, and I actually opposed, as did the whole House of Representatives. And that in turn was stuck inside an even bigger telecommunications bill that revised regulation of telecommunications for the internet era. So all of this was taking place in an environment when we had an internet before us. We could see where it was headed. It wasn't there yet, but our shared vision for it was of a virtual forum for exchanging information and ideas on an unprecedentedly broad scale, and it would be planetary, and it would enlighten the planet. So in Congress, we marveled at the possibilities. We were talking on the floor as we were debating what became Section 230, how students would have access to the world's knowledge. Citizens could have myriad opportunities for self-expression and civic participation, and entrepreneurs could address markets that were far away from home at near zero cost, frictionless. Physicians and scientists could collaborate more deeply and solve problems faster than they ever had been able to do in human history, and so on. So it was a very grandiose vision. Remarkably, it's more or less come to be. That vision that animated Section 230 back then, and that at the time motivated admirably bipartisan cooperation, because this was a very bipartisan effort, has given us user-generated content, very different from all of what went before in telecommunications, where TV talked to you, radio talked to you, newspapers talked to you, maybe you could print a letter to the editor if you were really lucky. But for the most part, we were all passive receptors, and the media came at us. Now that equation was flipped, and suddenly we've got millions and ultimately billions. It was millions back then, it's billions today, of content creators. And we have things like Wikipedia, which didn't commence until after Section 230 was enacted. It now contains, you know, compare this to the Encyclopedia Britannica, which was setting the benchmark at the time. The Britannica was a lot of volumes, but, you know, it had thousands of articles. 56 million articles are on Wikipedia today, and they're written and edited entirely by users. And the rate of change and improvement on Wikipedia is remarkable in itself. They have 1.9 individual edits per second, and it's free. The Encyclopedia Britannica was $1,000. You know, this is free to everybody with an internet connection. And there are more than 1.5 billion unique visitors that consult Wikipedia every month. So we've got this, we've got e-commerce, we've got a parade of marketing studies that show us that the vast majority of retail consumers rely on customer reviews. We've got, you know, hundreds of the most popular social media websites that connect friends and family, exchanging news and views. And, you know, we probably thought that market was saturated by 2020 when we had billions of people creating content on various websites, social media and otherwise. But then the global pandemic hit and we realized those virtual connections are more important than ever. So the vision that we had a quarter century ago really has come to pass. There's an awful lot of good that's come with it, but obviously that's not the whole story. And we also unleashed the whirlwind when we let everybody say what was on their mind.
Absolutely. So you talk about user-generated content and the importance of that in the internet. Now, what does that have to do with Section 230? What was Section 230 in a nutshell? What is it? And what problem was it trying to solve?
Yeah. So what the law does is allocate responsibility for what is said. When users are creating content, they are in the best position to control whether that content is lawful or not, and they should be held primarily responsible. And that's what Section 230 does. Again, we have to recognize that the paradigm was flipped with the internet, so the content creators are now all of us, all the people that are online and submitting our art or our words or our video or our, you know, you name it, anything that can be digitized. We're putting that stuff up there. We should be responsible for it. But because there are millions and indeed billions of us doing this and converging on individual platforms, it's now the many against the one. And is it reasonable, we asked, for the law to require a platform to review all of this content and take legal responsibility for it? And the answer emerges from asking the question itself. It's just overwhelming. It's an unreasonable legal burden. And therefore, we did make the platforms liable, but in a qualified way. They would become liable only when they themselves became involved, even if only in part, in either creating that content or subsequently developing it. And so primarily, the content creator is responsible. Secondarily, the platform is responsible if the platform becomes involved in that content creation. So that's how 230 works. Without it, what would happen is either it would be unmanageable for people hosting websites to have user-created content. They would have to employ armies of content moderators and lawyers and so on to review it. So at least for medium-sized and smaller websites, it would be untenable. Only the largest could possibly do that. And alternatively, they might say, you know, there are other ways to be in business on the internet, and user-created content is just going to have to go because we can't afford it. Both of those things would result in less speech and less opportunity for people to express themselves. So 230 strikes that balance. of saying the liability is going to rest primarily with the content creator and then with platforms if they become involved in the content creation themselves.
Makes sense. So before Section 230, there were, I believe, lower court cases that were conflicting that were sort of saying different things. And the point of Section 230 was to add some clarification. Is that right?
Yes. And in fact, New York was the locus for the leading litigation on these subjects. And what the New York court, had, the Supreme Court, which is the trial court in New York, had said right before we decided we needed to legislate on this in Washington, is that only if a website had no rules whatsoever, no rules of the road about what people could say, would the website itself be protected from lawsuits challenging on any legal ground that content. We realized that that would be the end of the internet as it was then and as it's become. It would be an end to real-time communication. It would be an end to anything like the World Wide Web where people from around the world can talk to each other. There's just too much content for people to review and to accept that responsibility. It would just either dry up or become much more sparse. And so that's why 230 came about, really, was to make sure that that legal doctrine, which would have been a big jackboot on top of the internet itself, did not prevail.
Well, I think that's a great explanation of how things were then, what led to Section 230 and what Section 230 is. So let's get to modern times. Let's get to today. So in our film, Leave a Decent Comment, you talked about how Section 230 benefits not just big tech companies, but all web traffic, big and small. So I'd like to play a short clip and then ask you to expand on that. So we'll take a listen now and we'll come back in a few seconds.
In the 21st century, when virtually every business has both an online and an offline presence, that business simultaneously benefits from the protections of Section 230 when it is eligible for them and is made liable for the postings of users when the website itself is a participant, even if just in part, in the creation or development of that content. And that law applies equally to everyone as well, without which the internet really could not function, or at least it could not function as a friendly place for individual people to post content that they have created.
So, Representative Cox, so in there you say that Section 230 applies equally to everyone. And I know you think this is a very important point. So why is this so important? And can you expand on it? And maybe with the context of, I believe people who are more skeptical of 230, they will frame the argument as this is a bigger benefit to big tech. So if you would just indulge your audience and lay out your thoughts on this.
Yeah, it's often said that 230 is a special benefit for tech companies that nobody else enjoys. But as that little clip that you played highlights, everybody is treated equally on the internet, and everybody is treated the same way off the internet. The internet is not the same as other regulated forms of telecommunication or other forms of communication more generally, including journalism. The problem to be solved on the internet when we are looking at platforms that host for free the content that's created by millions of people, if we want to keep that going, the problem to be solved is, you know, how can we protect the right and the opportunity of people to have this benefit to express themselves without overwhelming the platforms that are hosting it for free with lawsuits. Because every single piece of content that is posted on the web is a potential lawsuit. And if you have to, even if you're on the winning side of all those lawsuits, if you have to defend yourself every time somebody complains, it very quickly would overwhelm you. Judge Alex Kuczynski, then the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, made this point in a very colorful way when he said that if there were not some protection for websites that host content that they can't possibly take legal responsibility for and read in advance, they would suffer death by a thousand duck bites. And that's what Section 230 really is protecting against. But everybody has that protection. Everybody that's online, they're all treated the same. So it's not a special benefit for, you know, people that are online that nobody else has. When the New York Times has an online version and it has a comment section and so on, yeah, that's all protected by 230. The same for the New York Times as for everyone else.
Great. So I think that leads into another question, which was the idea that people who are more skeptical of 230 will talk about 230 is a subsidy for big tech from the government. And my understanding of this claim is that because internet companies don't have to face liability for third-party content, this gives them a type of advantage. What's your reaction to that? And am I summarizing that argument well enough?
Yeah, I think so. I've heard it as you have, you know, often enough. But it's an abuse of language. I mean, we know what a subsidy is, and there's obviously no subsidy being paid by taxpayers to companies that are doing business online. To the contrary, what's happening is that companies doing business online are offering their websites for free to users who create content, and they are, in exchange for doing so, told that their legal liability will be manageable. They won't be unqualifiedly protected, but they will not be expected to read and review and legally analyze in advance all of the content that's posted on their website. Without that kind of a regime, it would simply be impossible to have anything like what we know today as the internet.
And so one of the criticisms that we hear on Section 230 is generally the idea around political bias. And you've mentioned that you don't think Section 230 is the right way to deal with this political bias that may be online. And so do you think that political bias in social media or big tech is an issue? And if so, how would you recommend addressing it? And does it need to be addressed?
Yeah, this is a very puzzling kind of a complaint, it strikes me, because it comes, you know, from a variety of quarters for a variety of different reasons. But the idea that all websites should be viewpoint neutral is just sort of at odds with what the whole internet is about. The great thing about the internet is that it gives voice to a multiplicity of viewpoints, and we can find just about whatever we're looking for someplace on the internet. That's very different than the world that existed prior. We used to have a lot of concentration in media that we no longer have. And so I think we're much better off today than we ever have been before for that reason.
And another point that I know you and I have talked about is this idea of viewpoint neutrality, which you just mentioned. So do tech companies need to be unbiased in their moderation? Is that a requirement for Section 230? Should it be a requirement?
Well, first of all, it's not. The law says nothing of the sort. But second, I don't see how it could be. You know, could we tell the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee that they cannot have user-created content on their website that is only favorable to their political point of view? Is the DNC now going to have to host content that it disagrees with? Is the RNC going to have to host, you know, socialists now because, after all, that's another political viewpoint? Nobody would think that's reasonable. And Section 230, we have to keep in mind, governs literally millions of websites, all of which host user-created content. So asking them all to follow government neutrality guidelines would go beyond impracticability, and it surely would be impracticable, to impossibility.
So on a related and important subject, something I really want to get into in this podcast, which is the idea of Section 230 in the First Amendment, which we really didn't touch on much in the film, but I think, and I think you think as well, that it's important that we do dive into that. So can you explain to the audience what Section 230 has to do with the First Amendment, with freedom of speech, how this all relates?
Yeah. The First Amendment protects every American from government control of their speech, of their freedom and free exercise of religion, of their right to assemble. It protects every American, and that includes Americans who assemble in the form of nonprofit or for-profit organizations. Businesses have First Amendment rights. Everybody that's not the government has First Amendment rights that protect them from government control of their speech and their religion, and their right to associate and assemble and so on, petition their government. All of these things require that we keep in mind the difference between what is government on the one hand and what's the private sector on the other hand. All of the websites that we are talking about here, there are such things as government websites, but that's not what we're talking about. All of them are private activity. And private activity is activity that is the beneficiary of the First Amendment. The state, whether it's the federal government or individual states, is what's controlled. So I have a First Amendment right to speak and to think and so on and to express myself in whatever form I want. I can wear a sandwich board and walk down Main Street, or I can post on some website and nobody can tell me what to say because I have a right to think and say what I believe. There are some well-known limits on this. I can't yell fire in a crowded theater and so on, but I have First Amendment rights as an individual. Now, if I start a website, then my website also has those same First Amendment rights. So what gives websites, including the largest ones, but also the medium-sized ones and the small ones, the right to have their own policies for what they're going to put up? If I'm the DNC, I'm only going to put up, progressive stuff. If I'm the Republican Party, I'm only going to put up, free enterprise stuff and lower taxes and so on. What gives these websites that right is not Section 230. It has nothing to do with it. It's the First Amendment. And so when people want to tell websites they have to host my content, what they're really saying is, we want the government, which is the party that is restricted by the First Amendment, to be able to force you, private actor, to host content with which you disagree. And not surprisingly, there are lots of court cases that say the First Amendment doesn't allow that.
Well, great. I think that's an excellent explanation of the First Amendment and how it relates to 230. So I wanted to dive into a little bit of case law surrounding this and to see if that can inform us a little bit. So there are cases like the famous Times v. Sullivan, or lesser-known cases like Smith v. California, which involved the Supreme Court holding that bookstores weren't liable for obscene books that they may carry. I believe this was a local ordinance. And I was curious how you think these may or may not relate to Section 230. The Smith case seems interesting. It seems to be maybe an analogy for a business hosting content that they didn't create and not being liable for it. So I'm curious if you think that's just an analogy, if it's correct, or legally how this all relates.
Yeah, the Smith case from back in the 1950s, which involved a bookseller, is somewhat analogous in the sense that booksellers are not responsible for reading all the books that they sell. And even if there is something illegal, in this case it was obscenity, in the book that's being sold, That's somebody else's problem and not theirs. Smith is a little bit in a posit in the sense that the court also, you know, took issue with the obscenity statute itself. And so there was a question about whether this book really should have been illegal in the first place. But yes, for at least that first portion of it, one can draw an analogy.
And do you think that there are other court cases either that are going on now or previous cases that inform which direction the court may hold if there are challenges to 230 or that inform the case law around 230?
Oh, most certainly. You know, in terms of Supreme Court cases, you know, fast forward from the 50s to the 70s and Florida passed a law that said, you know, political candidates have a right to reply to their critics free of charge in whatever newspaper criticized them in the first place, sort of a viewpoint neutrality law along the lines of what some people would like to do with Section 230. Well, the Supreme Court said that even in a highly concentrated local market where the Miami Herald was the only voice, the newspaper's First Amendment right to print only things that they want to print is what controls. And so it's a good example of how private parties, whether they're, you know, platforms, publishers, what have you, do have these First Amendment rights. And that is the source of their ability to, using today's vocabulary, moderate content that is not carry content with which they disagree. I think the fact that in today's context, that disagreement comes in the form of terms of service that a user signs up to. Remember, this is a contract between a user and a platform. The user isn't paying any money usually, but they do promise and they form a contract this way that they'll agree to the standards that the platform itself wants to use in hosting content. So in addition to that First Amendment issue, you've also got a contractual issue.
And what do you think of the argument about some of these tech companies, these websites, maybe are more like a public square? Do you buy into that?
Well, the public square, you know, is a judicially created notion that could be, at least theoretically, applied to, you know, very large, dominant websites that you know, effectively function in that way. Unfortunately, for that argument, it's been made in U.S. courts over the last several years and has come up a loser every time because of the distinctions between the company town paradigm that gave rise to that doctrine in the first place and the reality of the internet, where there really are a lot of alternatives, even if people say that most people are using this or that site.
Great. So one argument, you know, for using the First Amendment as a legal shield, perhaps, for 230 is that without these protections, companies big and small would restrict user-generated content, fearing that the government would hold them accountable for any wrongdoing, such as libel or defamation claims. But those who are skeptical of 230 say that it's Section 230's protections that are allowing for so-called big tech to over-moderate or what some say censoring content. So, you know, which is it? Is it Section 230 protects and promotes free speech online, or does it allow the restriction of free speech online?
Well, you know, there's a little bit of truth in the criticisms and in the responses. There's some overlap because the law at bottom allows private ordering. It allows websites to do their own thing. The idea being that if you let 1,000 flowers bloom, you will have come up with a rough justice way of solving some of these problems rather than the alternative, which is to have a government rule and government enforcers of that rule. So I can tell you that our idea in writing the law in the first place was to provide an incentive for people to keep the internet from becoming a sewer, to make sure that reasonable standards of you know, civic discussion or exchange of ideas or just civility online could be maintained by websites. Not all websites have chosen to do this. And I think because the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law that restricts platforms, doesn't say platform, but it means all private conduct, as I've mentioned earlier. We can't in Congress get by with passing such a law that the best we can do is incentivize this conduct. I will say that, you know, just net, the balance that's achieved by Section 230 is not perfect because when it comes to balancing the interests of speech on the one hand and speech control on the other, perfection just isn't attainable. But as Winston Churchill said of democracy, no one pretends it's perfect or all wise. It may in fact be the worst form except for all the others. I don't think one can discuss Section 230 repeal or reform without very explicitly taking responsibility for what the proposed alternative would be. And the alternative to private ordering is government regulation. While that's a perfectly acceptable approach to some aspects of our economic lives, it's the most dangerous approach when it comes to speech. I recently listened to a Harvard Law School lecture on this topic in which the lecturer's proposal for replacing Section 230 was federal government regulation. And his list of faults with the current approach, chiefly the various kinds of objectionable speech that are now at large, was thorough and quite convincing. But his supposed remedy of benign federal overseers of speech who would replace private actors as the enforcers of rules concerning what can and can't be said, that was just whistling past the graveyard of some of the worst chapters in United States and world history. I think of Woodrow Wilson when I mention this, who gave us what historians today, you know, think of as the nation's first and only ministry of propaganda. We've looked down the barrel of these problems before and happily since the beginning of the 20th century walked away from them.
So is it fair to summarize a lot of the debate? The people on the various sides of this issue may agree in large part on some of the issues, obviously disagree on some, but it's really on the solution that we're really having these debates.
I think that's right. I think we have to go back to the film and take inventory of what some of these complaints are, what some of the diagnoses of the problems are. Senator Cruz pointed out that biased journalists have been with us forever. But he said there's never been any kind of journalistic outlet with the kind of monopoly power that big tech has. And I would just, you know, ask for a little more humility, if you will, in that problem diagnosis, because I think it's hyperbole. Facebook obviously doesn't monopolize journalism in the United States. So, you know, the problem definition is important in inferring solutions. In recent American history, there have actually been much more concentrated centers of power in journalism than we have today in the form of NBC and CBS radio networks in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and then the big three television networks that dominated broadcast TV for 40 years until the 1990s. Another observation I'd make is that this complaint that big tech has monopoly power has its own obvious remedy, which isn't repealing Section 230. If the real problem is monopolistic abuses, then those can and should be addressed with antitrust remedies. Repealing Section 230 would very likely lead to further concentration of market power among big tech because it would, as we've discussed, raise the costs of content moderation sky high. So now websites would be liable for everything said on their platforms, and so they would have to employ armies of content moderators and lawyers to review and weigh it all. And as with all regulatory costs, the biggest companies would be the ones that could best afford it. So Facebook and Twitter would probably stay in the user content hosting business, and all their smaller competitors wouldn't be able to afford the costs.
Great answer. I definitely think that we're going to see a lot of talk about antitrust, and obviously that's becoming a big topic as well nowadays with tech. I'd like to ask if you have any other thoughts specifically on the First Amendment and Section 230, or other general thoughts on 230, either related to the film or just something else that you think we need to get across to our audience.
Well, I think first of all, the opportunity to be a reviewer in a film that one has appeared in is really unique, and I appreciate the opportunity. Second, talking about these subjects further in a more discursive format, I think is also enjoyable and hopefully fun for our listeners. But lastly, I'd say that we have to remember this film was made during COVID, and you had to do the remarkable job of filming everybody in separate locations, remotely, all over the country, and then put it together into one piece. What that meant in part was that even though it comes across as looking like we're all responding to each other's points, we really weren't. These were all sort of individual monologues. And having this podcast, subsequently, we can now actually respond and analyze some of the points that the other people in the film are making. So I think it adds color to it, and I think it's a great thing that you're doing.
Well, I appreciate that, and I do appreciate you being able to come back on. The films are usually shorter, 20, 25 minutes or even shorter, and it's hard to get everything in there. So these podcasts allow us to open up and provide more context and education to our audience, which is really what we're trying to do. So I'd like to play one more soundbite from the film and have you comment on this to close out the episode. So I'll play this short clip, and then we'll talk about it.
But competition and choice for internet consumers was what we had in mind when we wrote Section 230 in the first place, and it's more important now than ever.
So, Representative Cox, in that clip, you're talking about competition, but you're also talking about how Section 230 is more important now than ever. So I'd love to give you a chance to expand on that thought and tell us about that, but also what you think the world would look like if we didn't have Section 230.
Sure. So it's often said that Section 230 might have been a great idea back in the day, 25 years ago, when the internet was in its infancy. But now we have big tech, and the internet's all different, and there are billions of people involved, and so we have to start over. That isn't even close to what happened 25 years ago, because 25 years ago, we could already see that the millions would become billions. It was called the World Wide Web. It was a planetary form of communication. It was instantaneous. It was different in every way. There would be all of these users converging on individual platforms, flipping the paradigm of telecommunications regulation that had existed for a century before. So it's not as if the problems that we were discussing then were qualitatively different than the problems that we're facing now. There were then ample examples of horrible content on the internet, believe me. Now we have the same horrible content, we just have a much more vast scale than ever before. But these are the very same issues. What Congress is facing today are the very same issues that Congress was facing 25 years ago. The reason that 230 is more important now than ever before is that the millions have been replaced by billions. So the unreasonableness of requiring a website to take responsibility for user-created content that is posted in real time is greater than ever before. It's so unimaginable, the burden that would be placed by law onto a website attempting to host user-created content, attempting to do so in most cases for free, paid for only by advertising, they had to moderate that content, review that content, and so on. They almost certainly couldn't do it in real time. They would have to interdict the most fundamental aspect of the internet, which is its instantaneity, and instead we'd have, you know, some of the stuff eventually creeping up online. There's a book with the catchy title, The 26 Words That Created the Internet, by a cyber law professor at the Naval Academy, that posits that if you just took 230 away, most of the speech on the internet would be from corporations. It would be from large businesses that could vet all that content first, that could afford the cost of doing so, and that individual voices would just go away because the business model to support them would have been suppressed by the costs of liability and conforming to the new standard of government, which would be that you are responsible for what everybody else says, even though you never read it. So that's why 230 is more important now than it ever has been before. And it's also why a proliferation of voices is dependent on this kind of regime. The idea that marginalized voices would be better off without Section 230, to me, lacks all empirical basis, because we can easily compare what existed, you know, prior, and see that there were very few means of self-expression for almost anybody in the country, let alone people without means. So if we want to have marginalized voices find avenues for expression, if we want to have diversity of voices and so on, what we should be focused on are barriers to entry, competition, and vibrancy in that market. What we should stray far from is government control of speech, because that, more than anything, as history has shown, will result in the suppression of both popular and marginalized points of view that whoever is in charge of the government at the time disagrees with.
Well, I think that's a great place to end it. I will ask if you have any final concluding thoughts that you wanted to give.
I think that this discussion is a very healthy one. I'd just return to a point that we covered at the outset, which is that it's very easy to list all the problems from unfettered speech on the internet, or conversely, to list all the problems that come from allowing private platforms to moderate in any way that speech, because in both cases there are going to be outcomes that people disagree with and strongly. But we've got to keep in mind what the alternatives would look like, and the most persuasive attacks on Section 230 that I have seen do a very fine job of avoiding that question. I think I could very easily convince any audience that there are serious problems that we want to see go away and that we must make go away just by listing all the bad stuff that we know happens on the internet in any given day. It'd be much more difficult for me to come up with a way to get rid of all of that speech without substituting a whole new problem set that might be even more intractable. And so, you know, nobody has infinite wisdom in this discussion, because the problems are going to be never perfectly solved. I think we just have to content ourselves with the idea that if we go one way or the other, we will be better off. And in my judgment, if we go the route of government speech control, which is implicit in most of the solutions, where we pass a law that platforms must carry speech they disagree with, and platforms, you know, must do this or that to moderate content that we disagree with. If we go that government route, we have a rich history in the United States and the world to consult to tell us where that road paved with good intentions leads.
Well, thank you once again for lending your time and expertise. It's always appreciated.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I'll look forward to continuing to watch all of the films and listen to the podcasts that the Federalist Society is producing. This is a wonderful example of how there's some terrific user-created content out of the internet.
Well, we appreciate you saying that. Our guest today was Congressman Chris Cox, who represented California from 1989 to 2005 and was the co-author of Section 230. This episode is related to our film, Leave a Decent Comment, The Fight for the Future of the Internet. You can check out the film on YouTube, Facebook, or fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. As always, the Federal Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.